Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Today is Tuesday, October 20th. It's 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. And our first guest is David Rubin. He's an author. A lot of people will probably know that he's the author of Trump and the Jews. And I just learned a moment ago, which evidently I missed, there's a new press release that came out by Mr. Rubin. So first of all, good afternoon. How are you?
Well, I'm fine. I'm doing okay here in Israel, despite the lockdown.
Oh, despite the lockdown. Well, it's to be expected. So many other countries around the world, and even here in the United States, we're going through a second wave of infection. And countries don't have it all under control. That's really the big problem. So tell me, though, what's happened with the press release that you just issued today or yesterday, which unfortunately I haven't gotten up to?
Yeah, well, as you know very well, everyone in the United States is talking about the upcoming election.
Yes.
I gave a little bit of perspective on where the Middle East is holding on mm-hmm. the upcoming election in the United States. Obviously, the whole world is watching the election, you know, despite their
right.
Despite the whole world being focused on, you know, COVID-19 and all this, but the world is watching very carefully to see what's going to happen in the United States on November 3rd, and so is Israel, and so are the Palestinians, and so is the entire Arab world.
Well, what's really interesting about your concept, and I'm sorry that I didn't see it, but I was going to discuss that with you today, there are about 300,000 people who have both American and Israeli citizenship. And they are going to be involved in the vote. Potentially, they have 300,000. So that's going to be a crucial number, which in some states might actually make the difference between a win for one or the other. And so it might affect places like Florida, which is going to be a big place that's going to make an impact. And also the demeanor in Israel. American Israeli Jews who live in Israel tend to be supportive of President Trump, and American Jews, on the other hand, tend to be supportive of Biden. So how do you see that?
Well, first of all, you're correct. You're correct in pointing out that there are a lot of American Israelis American Israelis as opposed to Israeli Americans, which
right.
which means American Israelis who live here in Israel, and myself included, and my wife included, and my children included.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
you know, and for many years, I have to admit, 28 years I've been in Israel. For many years, I did not vote in American elections, and mm-hmm. it only started when Barack Obama was running for president, and I was very concerned that his views were going to turn into policies that would hurt Israel-United States relations, because I believe in a very strong relationship between Israel and the United States. That has always been my view, and you know, and I'm I think it's good for both countries, and I feel that I could see that Obama was heading in the wrong direction, and mm-hmm. and unfortunately, in the 8 years that he was president, the relationship got a lot worse. It really deteriorated. But then
well,
President
interestingly
Trump came
enough,
in.
Yeah, sorry, forgive me. Go ahead.
But then President Trump came in. He got elected, and it's been good since then. So, you know, obviously, Israelis love President Trump and think that he's doing a great job. And according to a recent poll of Israelis as a whole, not specifically American Israelis, but Israelis as a whole, 64% of Israelis said that they're hoping that President Trump wins the election. Only 18% of Israelis said that they hope that Biden wins the election. And 20% of Israel is Israeli Arabs, which means that virtually all Jews living in Israel want Trump to win. Now beyond that, I will tell you that American Israelis are heavily for Trump. There is no question about that.
Well, what's interesting, though, too, is when we are looking at the elections in America, Biden very recently said that should he become the president, that he will also change the policy of the United States with regard to Iran and a nuclearization program and a couple of other policies that may or may not impinge on the Jewish voter to some extent, one way or the other. How does that fare in the Middle East, even? Not just Israel. How does that fare throughout the Middle East? Because people are very scared of Iran.
Well, it used to be that in Israel, not just Israel, but in the Middle East as a whole. I speak about Israel all the time, yes, there is much more to the Middle East than Israel. The Middle East is overwhelmingly, there are over 20 Arab countries, and they have always been against whatever candidate in the United States who's running for president. Whatever candidate is against Israel, they're for him. But that has changed. Now we have countries like the United Arab Emirates, which just signed a peace agreement with Israel, they had a delegation arriving in Israel today to continue the process of strengthening that relationship, and so it's a big thing. Bahrain and Saudi Arabia, which hasn't officially declared normalization, but they are at least covertly working towards normalization. So there are those countries that are very happy and would be very happy for President Trump to win. To continue that, to help continue that process and support that process. Now, Biden, unfortunately, he would stop certain things. I don't believe he would move the American embassy, back to Tel Aviv. But I don't think he would undo that. I feel very sure. That he would ignore the Palestinian Authority's payment of salaries to terrorists. And number two, I am sure that he would get the United States or try to get the United States back into the Iran nuclear deal, which would mean this pandering to the Iranians again, and which would make those Arab countries that I just mentioned very upset because one of their main motivations for having that normalization of relations with Israel was to confront Iran, which is a great threat to them. So I think Biden would be disastrous for the Israel-United States relationship and for the United States consistency and positive image that President Trump has developed in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that seems to be, I think you're really quite right on about that. Well, there are a lot of other concerns as well, you know, that impact the whole region. And how does the, I guess, the sale of material as well as armaments to Armenia and Azerbaijan, how does that impact Israel over the scandal with Nagorno-Karabakh? Is Israel being drawn into it? Because the major actors in that whole situation is really Turkey. They're trying to undermine, Armenia, and they become very, very strong against them. And how does Israel play into that, or does it?
Well, I think that Israel is kind of stuck between their relationships with those three countries, Azerbaijan, Armenia, and Turkey. And but I am of the opinion, and on this I am contrary to Prime Minister Netanyahu, I am of the opinion that Israel should take a moral stand and should recognize what Turkey did to Armenia. They should recognize that what the Turks did to the Armenians, in which some 2 million Armenians were killed, that was a precursor of the Holocaust. And it's a fact that Hitler learned from that horror that took place, because the world looked the other way when 2 million mm-hmm. Armenians were killed by the Turks. I think that that's something that Israel, as the Jewish state, has a responsibility to take a moral stand on, and I would like that to be publicly recognized, the massacre of the Armenians, and I also think that being the Jewish nation being that that Armenia is a Christian nation, I think mm-hmm. that there is a lot of rapprochement that we could have, and the strengthening of relationship, given that there are a lot of Christians around the world who stand very strongly with Israel.
And do you understand, or is there a rationale for the state of Israel not recognizing the massacre that took place against the Armenians in the early 1900s?
Yes, I understand the reasoning which has to do with geopolitics, being that Turkey is a strong nation that Israel once had a very good relationship with.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very strong Muslim nation. Israel once had a very good relationship with them, and Azerbaijan, as you know, is a Muslim nation that Israel has developed a relationship with, including arms sales. But now they're in conflict with Armenia. So I think that Israel has to learn to prioritize, and I think that Israel's prime minister, in particular, being the leader of Israel, I think that he needs to take a stand. And because the relationship with Turkey has deteriorated over a number of years, not because of Israel's fault. It has deteriorated because the leader of Turkey, Erdogan, is a Muslim radical, and he has moved his country against Israel over a period of a couple of decades, and I think that Israel needs to recognize that once and for all, that our relationship with Turkey is not going to improve, and we should stop. Could be because we're not taking that moral stand on Armenia, that could be a reason why the relationship has deteriorated.
And is it really that Israel was concerned about the response from Turkey, even though from a perspective of the high moral ground, Israel should logically be on the side of at least the recognition of what happened with Armenians being killed over 100 years ago? So, is that the only reason? Because Turkey seems to be everywhere. They're in Libya, which was not expected. They're sending Syrians, former jihadists from Syria, into Armenia as well, into that battle, and they're having a fight with the Greeks over the demarcation of oil in the water, and with Cyprus as well. And they're probably challenging Israel as well with regard to crude oil underwater.
Absolutely.
What's stopping Israel?
That's absolutely true what you said. And what is stopping Israel? It's as I said, it's Netanyahu's inability to take a strong stand against Turkey.
Uh-huh.
He's avoiding conflict. Knowing that that it may lead to a further rupture in our relations, but the rupture is already there. There is no reason not to take a moral stand. We have strengthened our relationship with Greece and Cyprus as a result, partially as a result of the ruining of relations by Turkey.
Yeah.
I think there is no reason not to take a strong stand on this. And as far as Azerbaijan is, I think Israel can have some control and some influence because we did sell them military weapons, and Israel can have some influence over that situation as well. And letting Azerbaijan see that Israel is standing with Armenia, despite those arms sales that already have happened, I think that Israel can influence that situation as well.
Interesting. Well, we don't have much time, but I wanted to touch on one thing. The negotiators, Syed Erekat, he's a Palestinian negotiator, been around for years. He suffered COVID-19 infection, and he had, I think, in about 3 years ago, he had a lung replacement surgery. So he's in very critical condition. And I understand that on Sunday, he entered Hadassah in Kerem in Jerusalem Hospital. And why the compassion for him specifically? He's been Israel's enemy from way back. He goes back as long as he's been alive, practically. Is this part of a peace, an olive branch to the Palestinians? Are they going to? Does it make a difference to them one way or the other? Or do we know?
Well, I think that in general, olive branches are a good thing. But
yeah.
we have a basic principle in Judaism that we believe very strongly with, and that is. Those who are kind to the cruel will ultimately be destined to be cruel to the kind. And I think the message of that is clear. This is someone who was responsible for the death and wounding of hundreds, thousands of Israelis. And I see no reason to extend any olive branch to him. He should have been treated in a Palestinian hospital, and that is my feeling on this. I think you don't extend olive branches to those who want to slaughter you and have slaughtered you by the thousands.
Is there any backlash from Israeli society with regard to his being treated there? in Jerusalem?
Absolutely. There's been a lot of backlash from the terror victims, those who
mm-hmm.
have lost people in terror attacks, and those who have been
right.
wounded in terror attacks, and I stand among them.
I hear you. Well, as usual, it's been scintillating just to speak to you. I appreciate your making the time for our audience. All the best to you, sir. And, do you have any books on the horizon? Are you writing anything else of late?
Well, I am.
Are you standing on the
writing,
laurels of Trump and the Jews?
I am writing a book.
good for
it
you.
It is on a slightly different topic than Trump and the Jews, but...
Okay.
But it is related, and I will be speaking about it as things develop.
Excellent. Thank you so much. All the best to you.
Thank you.
Be well. Bye. Oh, how exciting. So, David Rubin, former mayor of Shiloh, if you translate it in English, author of Trump and the Jews, and just so worldly and so aware of what's going on in the Middle East, with interest in Israel, where he lives for 28 years as an American Israeli, and that's his new home, which is really fantastic. So let's look and see what else is going on in our neck of the woods, a little bit closer to home. And let me move on to let's talk about the United Arab Emirates delegation that has made history with Israel, but at the same time, the Palestinians call their behavior shameful, no less. Well, in an historic first visit by the Gulf Arab nation, the United Arab Emirates delegation arrived in Israel on Tuesday, that's today, to cement the normalization deal signed last month. U.S. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin and other American officials accompanied the delegation on Etihad Airways, a plane from Abu Dhabi to Ben Gurion Airport. They were given a red carpet welcome by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Foreign Minister Gabi Ashkenazi, and Finance Minister Israel Katz. "We are making history in a way that will stand for generations," Netanyahu had said. "I think that the visit of such a high-level delegation from the United Arab Emirates will show our peoples, the region, and the entire world the benefit of having friendly, peaceful, and normal exchanges." So the United Arab Emirates and fellow Gulf state Bahrain in September became the first Arab states in a quarter of a century to sign deals to establish ties with Israel. The deals were brokered by U.S. President Donald Trump. They were forged largely over shared fears of Iran and Washington, and its allies have said they would foster regional peace and stability, but they have prompted anger from the Palestinians. Wassel Abu Youssef, a member of the executive committee of the Palestine Liberation Organization, described Tuesday's United Arab Emirates visit as, quote, shameful, end quote. Speaking in Ramallah in the Israeli-occupied West Bank, he said it came amid Israeli settlement expansion in the West Bank, so on. So that's the story about that. The five-hour visit was restricted to the airport near Tel Aviv due to coronavirus concerns. That's what Israeli organizers had said. Yet this is a historical moment for the UAE country and Israel, and we're looking forward to Salam, which is peace in Arabic, in the region. One of the Etihad pilots could be heard saying in a video posted on Twitter by a U.S. Middle East envoy by the name of Ari Berkowitz. So very, very, very interesting, to say the least. So that's the story there. Let's move on to other things that that matter as well. Bear with me a second here. I want to move into our next screen. Okay. Well, let's look at what's going on all over the world. Probably this is really quite interesting with regard to Ireland. Ireland has announced a strict 6-week lockdown because the COVID-19 cases are surging. Seems Ireland will be the first of the European Union countries to return to coronavirus lockdown, Prime Minister Michael Martin said on Monday, that's yesterday, issuing a nationwide stay-at-home, quote-unquote, order, but insisting schools will stay open. Measures coming into effect in Ireland for 6 weeks from midnight on Wednesday will see all non-essential retail businesses closed and pubs and restaurants limited to takeaway or delivery service only. Everyone in the country is being asked to stay at home, the Prime Minister said in a televised national address. Only essential workers will be, quote, permitted to travel to work, end quote, he said. And citizens will be allowed out to exercise only within 3 miles of their residence. It's about 5 kilometers. Well, the government warned in a statement that there will be a penalty for violating the 5 kilometer restriction and that public transport will operate at 25% capacity to serve essential workers only. Martin said that schools and child care facilities are to remain open because we cannot and will not allow our children and young people's futures to be another victim of this disease. A ban on visits between different households and on indoor events will also be extended, although 2 households will be allowed to mix at outdoor venues such as parks. A social bubble program will also allow those living alone at risk of social isolation or mental health issues to mingle with one another, with one other household, really. So unlike under previous shutdown orders issued in March, elite and professional level sports will be permitted behind closed doors across Ireland, which has suffered 1,852 deaths from the coronavirus. Mm-hmm. Martin said that the Republic's present restrictions were probably Europe's strictest regime, but that, quote, further action is now required, end quote. If we pull together over the next 6 weeks, we will have the opportunity to celebrate Christmas in a meaningful way, he said. Lobby group Retail Ireland predicted tens of thousands of retail workers will be out of work in the interim. It is crucial that these measures work and we are in place to reopen retail in advance of Christmas, warned Director Arnold Dillon. We simply cannot contemplate serious rolling restrictions into the future. Martin said the government's aim was to move from level 5 restrictions back down to level 3 by December 1, and that would allow all retailers to reopen and restaurants to serve 15 customers outdoors. Even then, another lockdown could not be ruled out in 2021, he added. So Ireland has generally taken a cautious stance in fighting the fight against coronavirus. There are currently no green list countries on the nation's register of safe travel destinations, and the government enacted pub closures dubbed Europe's longest. Dublin's decision to return the nation to lockdown comes 2 weeks after the government rejected a similar recommendation from public health chiefs. At the time, Deputy Prime Minister Leo Varadkar said that the decision, the advice to take the country to a 4-week lockdown hadn't been thought through. So the coalition government admission that a longer 6-week lockdown is now necessary could leave it vulnerable to accusations it stalled the public health response to the surging virus. So there are a lot of issues for sure. And we'll see where all that leads to in reality. Now let's look at something a little bit closer to home. Bear with me a moment. 1 second. Where do I have this? One second here. Where is it? Well, let's look, well, a little bit closer to home, even though it's going to be in Argentina. But Argentina's COVID-19 cases have surpassed 1 million as the spike strains the health system. seems that Argentina will become the fifth country with more than 1 million coronavirus cases. Its health ministry confirmed on Monday, making it the smallest country or the smallest nation by far to reach the grim milestone after infections accelerated in recent weeks. There were 1,002,662 confirmed cases of the virus in the South American country on Monday night. The ministry said in a statement, in the past 24 hours, there were 12,982 new cases reported and 451 deaths. Well, the latest figures put it alongside the United States, India, Brazil, and Russia, all with populations greatly exceeding Argentina's 45 million people, according to a Reuters tally. Argentina is also grappling with low levels of testing. But for those being tested, more than 60% of recent tests are coming back positive, one of the world's highest positivity rates. The explosion in cases has strained hospitals and healthcare workers with intensive care unit beds in the country, more than 64% occupied. And in some provinces, healthcare systems are on the brink of becoming overwhelmed. I would like this to end now. I cannot continue at this pace, said Cynthia Jimenez, a resident intensive care doctor at Hospital Posadas, in Buenos Aires, a province, the country's hardest hit area. It tires you to see people who come ill with respiratory failure and you have to save them, she added. And you know that if you intubate, it will end badly for many. And that hurts, she says. Argentina imposed strict quarantine measures on March 20, shortly after the country's first COVID-19 case was confirmed, which initially helped slow the virus spread. The government has since eased restrictions in many parts of the country to help revive economic growth, leading to a rise in infections, and more than 26,000 people have died, for a COVID-19 fatality rate of about 2.7%, according to the health ministry data. So Argentina's borders remain closed to tourism, though domestic flights have resumed for people with government approval to travel for medical, family, or work reasons. So very compelling sort of news, that's to say the least. Bear with me a moment here. I want to move on to some other things. Since we're in South America, we might as well cover a couple of other issues. Bear with me a second here. 1 minute. Okay. 1 second as I move the pages. This is big, big news. Evidently, Evo Morales says that he now intends to return to Bolivia after an ally has claimed the election victory. So this is really very, it was unexpected. At least I certainly did not expect it. Maybe I haven't been following Bolivia as much as I should have. But exiled former President Evo Morales yesterday signaled his intention to return to Bolivia after his leftist heir, Luis Arce's sweeping presidential election victory. Arce, the former economy minister under Morales, he claimed victory in Sunday's election after exit polls suggested a crushing triumph over centrist rival Carlos Mesa. Mesa conceded on Monday, saying that Arce's 20-point margin of victory was, quote, very forceful and very clear. It is up to us, as befits those of us who believe in democracy, to recognize that there has been a winner in this election, said Mesa, a former president. Exit polls handed over 52% of the vote to Arce, with Mesa mustering just 31.5%, upending predictions he would force a second round runoff in November. And private polling companies showed Arce's winning by a similar margin. Official results are expected to take days. And despite the coronavirus pandemic, a record 87% of Bolivians voted, according to the Supreme Electoral Tribunal, exceeding the average participation of 80%. Arce, 57, said his victory was a return to democracy for the divided South American country. we have recovered democracy and we will regain stability and social peace, he said. Much attention now focuses on Morales, whose authoritarian 14-year grip on power left a bitter aftertaste for many Bolivians outside his largely indigenous Movement for Socialism, MAS party. Sooner or later, we're going to return to Bolivia, and that is not in debate, Morales told a press conference in Buenos Aires. My great desire is to return to Bolivia and enter my region. It is a matter of time, said Morales, who was ousted amid protests after his victory in 2019 elections was annulled over rigging allegations. Well, Morales resigned in November 10 after losing the support of the armed forces in the midst of the crisis that left 36 dead and hundreds wounded. Thwarted in his attempt to secure a fourth term, he initially fled to Mexico, but has since settled in neighboring Argentina after leftist Alberto Fernandez's election victory there. Morales thanked Fernandez and Mexican President AMLO, best known as AMLO, but his name is Manuel Andrés López Obrador, for their support. He also hailed congratulatory messages from other leftist leaders, Venezuela's Nicolas Maduro and former Uruguayan President José Mujica. Cuba's foreign minister Bruno Rodriguez lauded a people's victory, quote unquote, that would return justice and well-being to the brotherly Bolivian people. Viva Evo, it said. Morales said he had even received a call from Argentine Pope Francis on Monday. I felt that I was not alone, he said. The Office of United Nations Chief Antonio Guterres lauded, quote, highly participative and peaceful elections and encouraged political leaders to work together for national reconciliation. Arce was credited as the architect of the country's economic miracle under Morales, who became the country's first indigenous president in 2006. Over the next decade, he slashed poverty levels and modernized the country's infrastructure, boosted, one second here. Okay, so the election twice postponed. Over the next decade, he slashed poverty levels, and the election twice postponed due to the coronavirus pandemic was the first in 20 years not to feature Morales, though he remained a looming presence. Arce's opponents had warned that a MAS victory would herald the return of the ex-president, who faces arrest in Bolivia on terrorism charges after the right-wing interim government accused him of directing anti-government protests from exile. He is also being investigated for alleged rape and trafficking over allegations he had relations with underage girls. Morales dismissed the accusations on Monday, saying they were, quote, part of the dirty war being waged against him. Arce's victory will bring to an end the year-long interim presidency of conservative Jeanine Añez, who withdrew from the race a month ago over criticism that rose of her handling of the coronavirus pandemic that has left more than 8,400 people dead and infected 130,000. Her government has been accused of intimidation of MAS party supporters and Morales' associates. And Washington, which saw Añez's government as a key regional ally, said it was awaiting the official results. But President Trump and the United States look forward to working with whomever the Bolivians elect, a foreign State Department spokesman advised. And landlocked Bolivia is one of the poorest countries in the region, despite its rich natural resources, is experiencing its worst economic crisis in 40 years, with gross domestic product to contract by 6.2% in 2020. Frightening sort of stuff that goes on, isn't it? It's truly amazing what's transpired Now, let me quickly look to see if there's anything else in our hemisphere, both north and south, that we should be able to inform you. Okay, we get a little bit closer to home here. And that's what's going on in Arizona. So farming is drying up in Arizona as their water supply is becoming short. With a lack of restrictions on water use, owners of some large-scale farms in the United States are drying up underground water tables. All they have to do is buy the land to have access to as much free water as they want. In Arizona, farm owners and ranchers are digging ever deeper to irrigate their land, leaving other residents with low water reserves. Meanwhile, parts of the land have caved in, collapsing as the water is pumped up from beneath. So that's like a major, major hurdle. But it's amazing how the laws permit this. And it's actually disgusting because there's no conservation interest whatsoever. Anyway, it seems that the final Trump-Biden debate will feature a mute button to avoid interruptions. Will the final debate between President Donald Trump and Democratic rival Joe Biden will feature a mute button to allow each candidate to speak uninterrupted, organizers said on Monday, looking to avoid the disruptions that barred the first matchup. Trump campaign voiced objections to the change made after the president repeatedly talked over both Biden and the moderator at last month's debate in violation of its agreed-upon rules, but said the Republican would still take part in the Thursday night event, one of his last chances to reach a large primetime audience before voting ends on November 3rd. Well, the Presidential Commission on Debates said that each candidate's microphones at the debate in Nashville, Tennessee, would be silenced to allow the other to take 2 minutes or to make 2 minutes of opening remarks at the beginning of each 15-minute segment of the debate. Both microphones will be turned on to allow a back and forth after that time. President Trump is committed to debating Joe Biden regardless of last-minute rule changes. Commission in their latest attempt to provide advantage to their favorite candidates, campaign manager Bill Stepien said the Biden campaign will not immediately respond to a request for comment, and more than 30 million Americans have already cast their ballots, limiting Trump's chances of reframing a contest that national and state opinion polls show him trailing. Trump repeatedly interrupted Biden during a chaotic and ill-tempered debate on September 29, at one point provoking Biden to snap, "Will you shut up, man?" Well, they cut you off. Seems that Trump backed out of a second scheduled debate set for last Thursday over disagreement over the virtual format following his COVID-19 infection. At that time, he raised concern about having his microphone muted. You sit behind a computer and do a debate. It's ridiculous. And then they cut you off whenever they want, Trump said on an October 8 interview on Fox Business. Earlier on Monday, Trump's campaign said it was unhappy with the announced set of topics for Thursday's debate, arguing that it should focus more on foreign policy and asserting that the nonpartisan group was tilted toward Biden. Biden's campaign said that both sides previously agreed to let moderators choose subjects. It said Trump wanted to avoid discussing his stewardship of the coronavirus pandemic, which surveys show is a top issue for the voters. As usual, the president's more concerned with the rules of a debate than he is getting a nation in crisis to help it needs, Biden spokesman DJ Ducklow had said. The number of Americans who voted early reached 30.2 million on Monday, according to the University of Florida's United States Election Project. That number represents more than one-fifth of all the votes cast in the 2016 election. Early voting is likely to ramp up this week as more states open up voting centers for those who want to avoid possible coronavirus exposure at crowded election day polling sites. So compelling news as well. So let's just quickly look to see what else in our neck of the woods. Bear with me a moment. Now, this is interesting. Didn't expect this. Trump is going to remove Sudan from state terrorism sponsors' blacklist. President Donald Trump announced on Monday the United States would remove Sudan from its list of state sponsors of terrorism as soon as Khartoum sets aside the $335 million it has agreed to pay to American victims of militant attacks and their families. The deal could also set in motion steps by Sudan towards establishing diplomatic relations with Israel, a U.S. official had told Reuters. Following a similar U.S. brokered move by the United Arab Emirates in Bahrain, the details are still being worked out, the source has said. Although Trump made no mention of Israel in his tweet announcing the breakthrough with Sudan, rapprochement between Israel and another Arab country would give Trump a new diplomatic achievement as he seeks re-election on November 3rd. Sudan's designation as a state sponsor of terrorism dates to its toppled ruler Omar al-Bashir and makes it difficult for its transitional government to access urgently needed debt relief and foreign financing. Mm-hmm. Many in Sudan say the designation imposed in 1993 became Washington came about in 1993 because Washington believed that Bashir was supporting militant groups, has become outdated since he was removed last year, and Sudan has long cooperated on counterterrorism. While U.S.-Sudanese negotiations have focused on funds that Washington wants Khartoum to deposit in escrow to be paid for victims of al-Qaeda attacks on U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, 1998, U.S. government sources had said. News. New government of Sudan, which is making great progress, agreed to pay $335 million to U.S. terror victims and families. Trump had tweeted, once deposited, I will lift Sudan from the state sponsors of terrorism list. A Sudanese government source said that Khartoum was ready to pay compensation to U.S. embassy bombing victims. Thank you so much, President Trump. Sudanese Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok tweeted, we very much look forward to your official notification to Congress rescinding the designation of Sudan as a state sponsor of terrorism. While Trump can act on his own to remove Trump from Sudan from the list, congressional legislation is needed to ensure the flow of payments to embassy bombing victims and their families and immediate action on Capitol Hill is far from certain. Urging congressional action, Edith Bartley, a spokeswoman for Americans killed in the Nairobi bombing, said that the funds would meet a commitment by three successive presidents to condition the normalization with the United States on compensating survivors and their families of those who were lost to acts of terror. So a key sticking point in negotiations was Sudan's insistence that any announcement of Khartoum's delisting not be explicitly linked to normalization with Israel. Differences remain between Sudanese political and military officials on how too far to go in the warning of relations with Israel. Warning relations of Israel, and Hamdok, who runs the country together with military in a transition since the toppling of Bashir, told U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in Khartoum in August that the normalization issue should not be tied with Sudan's removal from the terrorism list. One possibility, a U.S. official said, would be for Washington to leave it to Sudan and Israel to go public later, possibly in coming days, with an agreement on opening relations. The United Arab Emirates and Bahrain in September became the first Arab states in a quarter of a century to agree to formal ties with Israel and forged largely through shared fears of Iran. So asked whether an Israel-Sudan breakthrough was imminent, Israeli Foreign Minister Israel Katz told Israel's Army Radio, I hope that the intensive contacts will yield positive fruit. So the Trump administration, which is also expected to offer economic aid, must now notify the U.S. Congress of its intent to take Sudan off the terrorism list. Remaining obstacle is that Congress must pass legislation restoring Sudan's sovereignty, sovereign immunity, a shield against future legal claims for past attacks once it pays the compensation it already owes. And Syria has lost that protection because of the transition designation. So really, really crazy. But amazing how much stuff has been changing. And maybe it bodes well, which would be cool. 1 second. This is really a shame, but it's happened. Churches are burnt as Chile, the Chilean anniversary rallies turn violent. It seems that tens of thousands of Chileans gathered in the central square of Santiago to mark the one-year anniversary of mass protests that left over 30 dead and thousands injured, with peaceful rallies on Sunday devolving by nightfall into riots and looting. People gathered early in the day in demonstrations downtown and in cities throughout Chile that gained size and fervor through the evening. Many touted signs and rainbow-colored homemade banners, calling it a yes vote next Sunday in a referendum over whether to scrap the country's dictatorship era constitution, a key demand of the 2019 protests. Well, the demonstrations, while largely peaceful early on, were marred by increasing incidents of violence, looting of supermarkets, and clashes with police across the capital later in the day, and fire truck sirens burning. All right, so let's just see what else we have here. Okay. Well, let's just think about what we're going to be doing tomorrow. Tomorrow, we're expecting Dr. Oren M. Levin-Waldman. He has written a new essay, which he shares with our readers every 2 weeks. I posted it yesterday. Bear with me a moment, so I go to our screen. And 1 second. One moment here. Here it is. The article of the essay is entitled, "If Only We Had a Meaningful Discussion About Taxes," by Oren M. Levin-Waldman. So hopefully you'll tune in tomorrow at 10 o'clock. And the information is already online on the top right-hand side of the page. You see in a graph box the article itself, which links to the article that was written. And so it's something to think about, and hopefully you'll find it interesting. So Oren M. Levin-Waldman will be discussing it live at 10 o'clock, and we'll move on. We believe we'll get this confirmed later on today. Sean Patterson Howard, the mayor of Mount Vernon, should be with us again tomorrow. She'll be on at 11 o'clock in the morning, and she'll be on till 12. So that's the story there. So it looks like we're all done for the day. Thank you so much for being with us. Always a pleasure to be with you. And we're gonna close out and go from there. So we'll speak to you tomorrow. Goodbye.